Despite his central concern with God, Thomas doesn't think that God's existence is self-evident. Thomas had great confidence in the capacities of human reason, yet he would not agree with St. Anselm or Descartes that God's existence can be proven directly from our concept of a most perfect being. Thomas does think, though, that our experience of the physical world holds enough traces of God's presence to provide the basis for a proof. This proof will lead us to the knowledge that God exists, and it can give us some hints about his nature. In approaching the question of God's existence, Thomas anticipates two objections that complicate any attempt to prove that there is a God. First of all, there's the problem that evil exists. The two world wars of the 20th century suggest that the problem of evil may loom larger today than it did in Thomas's time. But Thomas's readers knew plague and pillage, fire and famine all too well, as we still do today. Betrayal, brutality, rape, and murder are common to his time and ours. How then can any reasonable man suggest that there's a divine, benevolent being who creates and governs this world? The objector answers in words too calm for the bewilderment and anguish that lie beneath them.
It seems that there is no God, because if one of two contraries be infinite, the other would be altogether destroyed. But the name God means that which is infinite goodness. If, therefore, God existed, there would be no evil discoverable. But there is evil in the world. Therefore, God does not exist.
That's the question. Either there is God and no evil, or evil and no God. How can a good, all-powerful God stand idle while the work of his hand is wrecked and his creatures suffer? Would not nothingness be better than so much misery, the pain of the world, pain we all know? The second question is different. It stands on the pride of human reason, on the idea that science is self-sufficient. Science sets out to provide a rational account of the world in terms of principles and laws based on human experience. The natural sciences explain the physical world, and the social sciences explain human nature. The existence of God is irrelevant. Nature and society suffice. There's no need to go beyond them to account for our experience. The objector complains,
"It is superfluous to suppose that what can be accounted for by a few principles has been produced by many. But it seems that everything we see in the world can be accounted for by other principles, supposing God did not exist. For all natural things can be reduced to one principle, which is nature, and all voluntary things can be reduced to one principle, which is human reason or will. Therefore, there is no need to suppose God's existence."
The principle of economy applies here. In explaining things, we appeal to no more causes than are necessary. This tactic has been called Occam's razor. We must shave down our arguments to their most simple and direct components. Anyone today could say that science does a good enough job. Left alone, it'll do better still. The rationalist says there's no need to appeal to some mysterious source beyond the world to explain what happens in it. Don't reach for what lies beyond our grasp. Be content with what we can know. A bird in the hand, half a loaf. These are better than none. The first objection demands all or nothing. The second asks, if not all, why not at least something? Thomas answers from the Bible, "I am who am." He understood that to be the name of God. He turns to the philosophers to answer the question, does God exist? Thomas constructs one overall proof, but he presents five versions of it. His result goes far beyond the pagan Greek philosophers. Thomas insists on beginning with concrete things rather than abstract ideas.
Human knowledge is derived from sensible objects.
So all five ways of proving God's existence begin with first-hand, sensible experience, but each way has a different starting point in experience. These ways are not original with Thomas. The first is drawn directly from Aristotle, the second from the Arab philosopher Avicenna, the third is from the Jewish thinker Moses Maimonides, the fourth ultimately from Plato by way of St. Augustine, and the fifth and most popular seems to have been drawn from a Greek church father, St. John Damascene, though it was widespread among both Christian and pagan authors. Thomas's five ways compose almost a miniature of his intellectual background. His arguments are not entirely new, but they're modified and deepened in very important ways. As we'll see in more detail, the first way to prove God's existence starts from the fact that things are in motion. The second way starts with the fact that one thing acts upon another. The third proof begins with the fact that none of the things in our experience, neither you nor I nor any other thing, exists by absolute necessity. It's quite conceivable that we might never have existed at all. The fourth proof begins with the fact that things differ in respect to various qualities, some being more or less good, some more or less meaningful, more or less beautiful. And in the fifth way, we observe that things usually act according to regular patterns which reflect some intelligence or order. Each way is meant to bear its own weight. As spokes of a wheel, all five converge on a common center. Yet the five together are meant to provide the mind with the basis for further knowledge of God. We should point out in passing that these famous five ways are not the same as the three later proofs of God that have been attacked by David Hume, Immanuel Kant, and other modern philosophers. These later proofs were to become current in 18th century textbooks, and they reflect the more modern rationalist and idealist presuppositions of the Enlightenment. Let's look in detail at the first of Thomas's five ways of proving God's existence. The first way is sometimes called the argument from motion. It's so important in philosophical history that we should spend some time developing it. Then we'll be able to see by example how Thomas would develop his other four ways. He begins,
"The first and most manifest way is the argument from motion. For it is certain and evident to our senses that in the world some things are in motion."
Thomas has begun with what he takes to be the easiest starting point. It's obvious, undeniable, that things move and change. You can wave your hand to prove that, or look at the setting sun. It's worth noting that for this first proof, we don't need to agree with the Greek philosopher Heraclitus that all things change. It's enough to find one single thing in motion and to ask what that means. But you have to do more than wave your hand to establish the existence of God. We have to determine the conditions where movement takes place. To do that, Thomas takes a not-so-small first step from observation to analysis. He takes up concepts he's learned from Aristotle.
"Now, whatever is moved by another."
But this, of course, requires an explanation.
"Nothing can be moved except it is in potentiality to that towards which it is moved, whereas a thing moves inasmuch as it is actual."
This follows from the understanding of movement that Thomas shares with Aristotle.
"For motion is nothing else than the reduction of something from potentiality to actuality."
This argument will be a little plainer if we reshuffle the statements. The movement of anything is the passage from something potential to something actual. But that passage can't take place unless a movement is caused by something independent of the thing that moves. And so whenever we see something in motion, we can know it's been moved by something else. Your hand waves, but you make it wave. Thomas's analysis makes explicit a common fact of our experience, the distinction between being and becoming. For example, there's a difference between being a good musician and having the ability to become a good musician. Water can become hot only if it's first not hot, and yet is able to be hot. And of course, experience teaches us that different things have different capacities appropriate to them. It's natural to wonder why philosophers ponder such obvious facts. For Thomas, that's philosophy's job, to think about facts and situations in order to produce general conclusions about the origin, nature, and purpose of such facts. Philosophical conclusions challenge us to think deeply and critically about unfamiliar aspects of the familiar things about us. Thomas has learned from Aristotle that because movement is very smooth and fluid, it's the most difficult notion for the mind to attend to. The mind loves to pin things down, especially by naming, classifying, measuring them. But in this instance, our attention's directed to the passage itself. When water is heated, it's on the way from one state to another. Aristotle asked, "What is operating here?" Three things, he said. First, there's the common substrate, he said, the portion of water that undergoes the change and survives in the result. Second, there's an initial privation or lack, the water's absence of heat. And finally, there's a new actuation, the influx of heat into the water as it comes to a boil. This is all well enough, but the important point is this. The change itself is neither the water nor its cold state, nor the fire. The change itself is mere fluidity, a pure passage. Change is none of the above factors. It's their transformation. Some factors, such as the cold state, pass away. Others, such as the water itself, remain, more or less, throughout the entire process of being transformed. If we can accept the story so far, then we should accept the next point. Whatever is moved by another. With an eye to Aristotle, who would have nodded in agreement, Thomas continues.
But nothing can be reduced from potentiality to actuality except by something in a state of actuality.
And Thomas gives us an example.
Thus, that which is actually hot as fire makes wood, which is potentially hot, to be actually hot, and thereby moves and changes it.
Anything that changes must be acted upon by something else. Otherwise, we have a logical contradiction. For example, water cannot heat itself. If it could, it would have to be simultaneously and actually both hot and cold.
Now, it is not possible that the same thing should be at once in actuality and potentiality in the same respect, but only in different respects. For what is actually hot cannot simultaneously be potentially hot, but it is simultaneously potentially cold. It is therefore impossible that in the same respect and in the same way a thing should be both mover and moved, that is, that it should move itself. Therefore, whatever is moved must be moved by another.
Thomas's students might well have objected here that they'd all moved their own feet to get to his lecture. Indeed, Thomas himself distinguishes living from non-living things precisely on the ground that the living are able to move themselves. Plants move themselves by growth and nutrition. Higher animals move themselves by locomotion and perception. But Thomas thinks that a living thing moving itself does not contradict the principle that all things in motion are moved by yet another mover. Within a complex organism, Thomas distinguishes the moving center of animal life, the vital soul, from the members and organs which are moved by it. The animal as a whole does move itself in walking, but it moves itself by one part, the soul, moving other parts, the members and organs. In Thomas's view, we must then account for what moves the soul. Again, we might ask, why is such a fuss being made over what's so obvious to our common sense? But it's important for Thomas that we not simply rest the case upon ordinary sense observation. Analyzing motion in terms of actuality and potentiality is meant to probe more deeply into the nature of motion and to show what necessarily operates within it. This requires us to follow the analysis wherever it may lead us, even if it leads us beyond motion to God as unmoved mover. Still working with Aristotle's reasoning, Thomas advances the next step in his argument.
If that by which something is moved be itself moved, then this moved mover also must needs be moved by another, and that by another again.
In mapping out this sequence of movers, Thomas explores Aristotle's concept of motion as change from potentiality to actuality. Not all philosophers will agree with Aristotle and Thomas that change is best analyzed using the concepts of actuality and potentiality. But there's a second point that's even more controversial. In his imaginary conversation with Aristotle, Thomas says,
"But this series of moved movers cannot go on to infinity, because then there would be no first mover, and consequently no other mover, and therefore no motion, seeing that subsequent movers move only inasmuch as they are moved by the first mover."
Then Thomas adds briefly,
"As the staff moves only because it is moved by the hand."
That is so cryptic that it seems more like code than a helpful illustration, but it's clear to Thomas's students. In the Summa, Thomas tells us that he is addressing beginners in theology. We need to remember that these beginners have already completed their studies in philosophy. He can count on them to have enough background to decode his reference. Indeed, he's probably taken many of the students at the Dominican House of Studies through Aristotle's proofs in the physics and the metaphysics. But if we're to appreciate the force of Thomas's argument, we need to remind ourselves of what was already familiar to his students. This concerns whether it's possible or impossible to have an infinite series. Taken at face value, an infinite series of movers seems quite possible. We might wonder if Thomas would so confidently declare that an infinite series is impossible if he'd known that the universe in its present state is several billion years old and may have proceeded from an even older state or series of states. Well, it so happens that we do know how he'd reply. One of the controversial issues among the learned of his day was whether it could be proved that the universe began at some definite moment of time, or whether instead it had always existed. Teachers in the Faculty of Arts at Paris practically identified philosophy with Aristotle. They were convinced that he had demonstrated the world to be eternal. But some theologians insisted that the very thought of an eternal world was contradiction. In this dispute about an infinite series, Thomas disagrees with the philosophers, but he's even more put out by the overzealous and indiscriminate attacks of some theologians. In a rare departure from his usual serenity, he grumbles that these theologians who think that an eternal world is a contradiction talk as though wisdom begins with their hawk-like vision.
Another surprising thing is that the best philosophers of nature failed to discern this alleged contradiction. The same situation emerges if we carefully consider the position of those who held that the world has always existed. For in spite of this, they teach that it was made by God, and perceived no logical inconsistency in this doctrine. Therefore, these theologians, who do decry such alleged inconsistency with their hawk-like vision, are the only rational beings, and wisdom was born with them.
Thomas earns no thanks from either group for his subtle position. As a Christian, he's willing to believe that time itself is created in the same act by which the eternal God continually creates the universe. Nevertheless, Thomas also holds there is no reason why God himself must precede his own creation in time. And so there's nothing inconceivable about the notion of an eternal universe. Philosophically speaking, the universe could be without a beginning. On the face of it, Thomas seems to contradict himself. He holds on the one hand that there cannot be an infinite series, and declares on the other hand that there can be such a series. But we're usually too hasty when we charge a trained mind with such an obvious contradiction. When Thomas insists that the series of movers cannot be infinite, he has in mind a second kind of series, a series quite different from a series that has no beginning. Still talking with Aristotle in the Summa Theologiae, Thomas draws a distinction between two senses of beginning. Then, on the basis of two beginnings, he distinguishes two kinds of series.
There are two kinds of causes. One kind is essential, the other, accidental. An essential cause of something is that which directly causes it through the cause's own power, as water is the cause of cooling. But an accidental cause of something is that which causes it indirectly. For example, by removing an opposing cause, as when it cools a house by putting out a fire.
In one sense, to begin is to start. Here a beginning is part of the movement which follows. A beginning is that movement's initial moment. But in another sense, to begin is to originate. Such a beginning is not merely a starting point, but is rather the very source and origin of the whole movement. As we'll see, a beginning in time is distinguished from a beginning cause. Modern cosmology theorizes that there was a condensed cloud point at the very beginning of our present universe, a cloud point existing even before the supposed Big Bang. But we can still entertain the suspicion that there was a previous state, a state before the emergence of our current universe. And before that, still another, and perhaps another, to infinity. But Thomas says that whether or not the time series has a start, there's a second kind of series, a series of causes or movers. This series makes its presence felt in time, but it's not itself essentially temporal. It's not successive or diachronic, but simultaneous or synchronic. We recognize something similar when we recognize that some necessary and sufficient conditions must exist to enable a particular event to occur. Modern holograms, Three-dimensional images in which every part contains the features of the whole reawaken our sense that many dynamic factors often coexist simultaneously in a complex whole. Ecological studies also remind us that natural events have complex and simultaneous causes. Nevertheless, our long-standing modern impulse is to break complex units down into the simplest elements and then arrange them in a time sequence. They seem only then to be more precise, more certain, neater. We're still prone today to speak of causation in terms of a temporal series of events. We tend to think of a cause as a preceding condition. Sequential causality has been aptly called two-event causation. Event A, say a billiard ball struck by a pool cue, occurs at time one. Event B follows at time two. The ball thuds against the table cushion. If we dare to say that A at time one causes B at time two, we have seen two-event causation. But Thomas speaks about another series that may be called one-event causation. A modern Thomist explains the notion this way.
Causing and being caused are not, therefore, two events, one taking place in the agent and the other in the patient. They constitute a single ontological event. It follows necessarily, and obviously, that it is impossible for them to be anything else than simultaneous.
An event may take place in one instant or over a series of moments, but the relevant series of causes operates simultaneously. Joint causation is necessary, as with a conductor in a symphony orchestra. Thomas's second series of causes simultaneously originates some event or result. Thomas calls this second series, the series of essential causes or movers, a per se series. Others have called it a vertical series to distinguish it from the horizontal time series. Whereas a time series need not have a first event, the per se series must have a first cause. There must be a source of motion, or there would be no motion in the first place. A first and ultimate source must move the other movers without itself being moved by another. This is the unmoved mover. The conclusion draws itself.
Therefore, it is necessary to arrive at a first mover, moved by no other.
But then Thomas adds, with a flourish,
and this everyone understands to be God.
There is no denying that this flourish is also a leap. Thomas leaps from what looks very much like the unmoved mover to what looks very much like the biblical God. This is the conclusion of Thomas's first way of proving God's existence. Each of his remaining four ways of proving God's existence ends with the same flourish. So, in the first way, we've seen that the unmoved mover is God. In the second way, the uncaused cause is God. In Thomas's third way, the necessary being is God. And in the fourth way, the perfect goodness is God. Finally, in Thomas's fifth and most popular way, the guiding intelligence is God. A modern interpreter has said that Thomas frees God from the categories of motion, causality, necessity, goodness, and governance, since in themselves these names are too restrictive. This interpreter says that only the category of being can be broad enough for God.
How does this get God out of the categories? If such a being were in a category, that category would have to be the category of being. Now, no act of existing can be a category.
In moving beyond these categories, Thomas moves beyond his philosophical sources, but he remains in the line of philosophy. We need to think a bit more about what Thomas has proven, if indeed he's proven anything. At issue in these five ways is not how a specific quality gets transmitted from one thing to another, rather the issue is how that quality exists at all. Thomas clearly says in the Summa that the movement he speaks about is not simply a movement from one place to another, nor an increase in size or weight, nor a change of color or shape. He speaks of movement in the most fundamental terms, so all these specific movements are, at bottom, the primal movement of coming to be. So Thomas's first way doesn't concern the transmission of motion from one thing to another. Modern physics can tell us much more about that. Rather, the first way of proving God's existence addresses why motion exists at all. What is at stake is the very existence of motion. Of course, we can ignore or neglect the original cause of motion. Indeed, we mostly do ignore it in order to get on with the demands of everyday life. Someone who always wonders about the origin of things is usually dubbed by practical people to be a poet. Maybe somewhat odd, or at least impractical. For Thomas, however, philosophy consists in consolidating that wonder, in entertaining it, in exploring it methodically, and in following wherever it leads. We can suppress the question that asks why the causes of motion exist, but if left alone, our questioning impulse leads us to seek an explanation for all indispensable aspects of the observed motion. To communicate the fact of existence is the prerogative of a being that does not come from others. This being exists by right. Such a being simply is. It is pure being. The absolute first being in the order of movers is itself ungenerated being. It does not come to be. The first mover communicates to others the being without which nothing at all would exist. In Thomas's words,
as long as the cause remains, the effect remains. If the cause is removed, the effect is removed too.
If this first mover didn't exist, there would be no movement. Since we began by observing that there is movement, then there must be such a being. The essential nature of an original cause is that it must be, through and through, pure, self-subsistent being. In the language of actuality and potentiality, the original cause is the pure actuality of existence. It needs no other being in order to exist, nor does it need to be explained or justified. On the contrary, the existence of everything else is explained and accounted for by the first cause. Thomas's four other ways of proving God's existence help us to see the richness of this pure being. Such a mover, itself unmoved, and such a cause, itself uncaused, is absolute and necessary being. It has all the attributes that belong to pure being. It is all that is good and highest, intelligent and purposeful. In a word, it is divine.
And it is this that everyone understands to be God.
Thomas has no doubt that human reason here catches a glimpse of the same God recorded in the Bible. Thomas believes God has revealed himself to Christians, Jews, and Muslims alike, and in his own way, to all mankind. But words can only do so much. It's time to reflect on the proof and to bring it to the test of our own experience.
This is the end of tape number one on St. Thomas Aquinas. The presentation is continued on tape number two.
Same God recorded in the Bible. Thomas believes
this is the end of tape number one on St. Thomas Aquinas. The presentation is continued on tape number two.